Listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. On tonight's special program, we'll be talking for the full hour with Chris Quigg, one of the authors of the recently released work Grace in All Simplicity, Beauty, Truth, and Wonders on the Path to the Higgs Boson and New Laws of Nature, an enthralling and accessible account of humanity's quest to make sense of our physical world, told through interwoven tales of inspiration, tragedy, and triumph. Also joining us for the show is special guest host Roger Rusak, a professor of physics at the University of Minnesota. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio. Hello, hello, everyone. This is Josh Weber. We are talking the full hour with Chris Quigg, the co-author of the recently published work, Grace in All Simplicity, Beauty, Truth, and Wonders on the Path to the Higgs Boson and Laws of Nature. Grace in All Simplicity narrates the saga of how we have prospected for some of nature's most tightly held secrets, the basic constituents of matter and the fundamental forces that rule them. Our current understanding of the world and universe we inhabit is a result of curiosity, diligence, and daring, of abstraction and synthesis, and of an abiding faith in the value of exploration. Chris Quigg is a distinguished scientist emeritus at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. He graduated in physics at Yale before moving to Berkeley for his doctorate. He's the author of an acclaimed text on gauge theories and critical works on high-energy collisions, quarks, neutrinos, and the Higgs boson. Helping us navigate the microcosmic and macrocosmic realms, Roger Rusak, a professor of physics at the University of Minnesota, is in studio along with Ian Graham Leesk, who everyone who listens to the show should know. Roger has spent his whole career testing and measuring the theory of quarks and leptons, conducting experiments in Europe and in the U.S., and has been part of many critical experiments in particle physics on neutrinos, quarks, gluons, and most recently, the Higgs boson. He grew up in the UK and went to Liverpool University for his undergraduate degree in physics and to Imperial College for his doctorate. In his downtime, he gets away from it all, sailing on the high seas and boats with varying states of seaworthiness. Chris, Roger, welcome to Right on Radio.
Thank you. It's great to have you here. This book is right there in the tradition with Simon Singh with his Big Bang, Roger Penrose with The Roads to Reality, and Bill Bryson with his A Short History of Nearly Everything, which we've had on the show in recent years. This book here is this brilliant compilation of the scientific discoveries that bring humanity to its current state of what I think of as universal anxiety. What these kinds of books have in common is that they don't require a science degree of the reader, just sustained attention. And that, of course, is why we have Roger here, because Josh and I don't know beans about any of this stuff. So we've got Roger in here to interpret and to ask some questions that will help our listeners clarify this. One of the things that I loved about this book, Chris, was that you and your partner, Robert N. Kahn, we'll talk about him in a minute, you have made this very accessible to ordinary people like myself, who are not a scientist. I'm a literary guy, and literary people don't know anything about science, although scientists seem to know lots about literature. It's not really fair. So, Roger, how do you guys know each other?
Well, I first went to Fermilab way back when I was at the age of 23. I was sent over from England as a graduate student, or postgraduate student, as we called them then back in England, to do an experiment in the new accelerator that was just being formed, just being built, or just coming online at Fermilab in Chicago. And Chris was one of the very eminent physicist there who was there well before me. And I would attend his lectures. And so basically we got to know each other through that way. And then along basically in the past, getting on for 45 years or so, maybe more. getting on for 50 years now. We've crossed our paths at CERN. We've crossed our paths at Fermilab. We've met and been to conferences, and we just, you know, in this community, you build friendships up over many years with a common interest about.
They don't look that old.
Yeah, you know, we feel it.
It's sometimes. The radiation.
I was wondering.
It's the neutrinos that did it, right?
Oh God. So, Chris, tell us how this book came about and how you worked with your partner on this. I mean, I was reading through it, I haven't read the whole book. It's too much in the notice that I had. But we've read, you know, between us have read most of it. And I noticed some differences in style sometimes. Well, did you have an editor that tried to pull it all together, or did you kind of both of you do your own thing?
Well, we worked very hard to pull it all together ourselves. Yeah. You know, some aspects of it are a bit autobiographical for me or for Bob. And so the first draft is written in the voice of the person who experienced it. But we both touched every word in the text many, many times. There was a lot of iteration. We are lucky in the present era that instead of sending packages of paper by Federal Express, you can send PDF files and then discuss.
Yeah.
So that has been very good for us. We are still speaking. That's always a question people want to know.
Yeah.
And I would say we've known each other forever, since graduate school, in fact. And I would say we have come to an even greater understanding and feeling for what each other is about, and able to take criticism, which took a little learning on my part at least, maybe on Bob's, and finding that if somebody that you trust isn't quite happy with a passage or a theme, maybe you should think about it again. Mm. So I think we both saved each other from time to time.
Well, as you can probably tell from the title of the show, I mean, its first cause is writing. It's about writing. Of course, the second cause in here is, you know, is about the science that you so eloquently develop in the story, in the book. But the writing piece of it fascinates most of our listeners. And writing about science, usually when we've all had a bit of science in college or in high school or whatever it happens to be. And, of course, it would often put people to sleep. They can't follow it. They don't know how to do it. It doesn't work for them. But you made it interesting. Was that a deliberate thing to try to separate yourself from scientific thinking, scientific writing?
Ian, we were really trying to be boring, of course. Well, both of us have taught extensively, and both of us have given many, many public lectures. And I think even in our teaching, we try to engage in storytelling and not just speak to the blackboard and say, here's an equation, and here's the next line of the equation, and so on, but to give the themes and to show the ideas behind what we're doing. We composed the book, or our aspiration for the book was that it was, in one sense, for readers of The New Yorker. So people who appreciate long-form nonfiction and who have the capacity to be interested in things that they didn't know they cared about.
Mm.
A lot of the great essayists that you read in The New Yorker and elsewhere are people who can engage you in topics that you never thought you cared about, and that if you had been asked just up front, do you care about this, you would have said, what's that about? That's something that we do in everyday conversation, after all. You may come to me and introduce a topic for people who know each other, say, and it might engage me. I might respond in some way. So as strange as it seems when you're writing a book, we view this as part of a conversation. We would like to think of the reader as forming his or her own thoughts in response to what we write, and to maybe shouting back at us or speaking. If you think about reading, even when you're reading silently, your voice is speaking.
Yeah.
And so it is a conversation in some sense, and we really wanted to emphasize that. One of the things that we do is to not follow a logical or chronological path, but to present things in the way that physicists experience them. An idea from over here, an idea from over there, a technological development, and so on, which may not seem to be linked at first, but in the hands of the right people, we will find those links and be able to make great developments out of them.
Well, part of your argument here is everything's linked.
Indeed, indeed. Right.
How did the table of contents come about, and how did you handle the different aspects of all of that between the two of you?
Well, we, of course, labored hard on what we would say in any piece of writing, probably even an email. What you leave out is the hardest piece of work that you have to do, deciding what to leave out.
Of course.
It's a vast, vast topic, and so we had to make judgments. We tried to give a full picture of the state of our science and how we got there. And importantly, the links with technology that enabled people like Roger to do the fantastic experiments that we do. So the order of the chapters we navigated very carefully and tried different orders and finally settled on the one that you see in the book.
Chris, I'm curious about this. So in sharing these elucidating accounts on redefining our place in the universe, did you have troubles in trying to explain difficult concepts without the aid of equations and diagrams and tables? Because I know in the introduction you say you try not to use those in the book.
Indeed, there are no equations, no footnotes, no drawings, no diagrams, anything like that. Again, in the spirit of appealing to people who like narrative, long-form, nonfiction, we wanted to set ourselves a task of writing as if we were writing for The New Yorker. And therefore, you find books that may have admirable features, but frequently they'll show equations kind of like wallpaper. And we didn't want to do that. You might also think of having photographs of the magnificent detectors, for example, that Roger and others build. It is true that a picture may be worth 1,000 words, but in some contexts, it takes 1,000 words to explain a picture. So we didn't want to put ourselves in that bit of a pickle in order to do it. And we tried as best we could to describe what was in the equations, maybe, but really to give the ideas behind them and how they work together.
So I like this idea, the idea of your book is a dialogue between yourself and the reader. I was wondering if you could talk about what was the impetus that led you to pursue working as a theoretical physicist in the first place? Was there a book, a lecture, or instructor that encouraged you to pursue research on particle physics?
When I was a child, of course, I read, we had a neighbor who had a telescope and would show the kids the rings of Saturn and couldn't be accused of being a groomer in those days because groomers hadn't been invented yet. So that's the way many of us got our introduction to science. Nature studies, looking at the sky, seeing the planets, the stars, and things like that. There were books that I was able to access in the public library. That was one of the great influences on my young life. And I had an uncle who was a medical doctor, an internal medicine specialist, who was a science groupie and would provide me. He had a complete collection of the Mr. Tompkins books, which he let me borrow and eventually bequeathed to me. So there were all these things going on, and I felt in some of those very thin books that were written kind of for young people that real scientists were speaking to me. I grew up in a town, a steel town in Pennsylvania, where all of my mathematically talented high school classmates wanted to grow up to be engineers and work for the steel company, a noble profession. A lot of them did that very successfully. I got the misapprehension early on that engineers applied the laws of nature and physicists got to make the laws of nature.
So when you were young, you did what a lot of us do, look up into the sky and were thoroughly intimidated.
But I had delusions of grandeur, which is a good thing when you're young. Then when I got to Yale, I had very good teachers in many disciplines. I did go through a brief flirtation with mathematical economics which actually has a lot in common with theoretical physics, except that you don't get to do real experiments, but a lot of the analytical techniques are the same. And there was a certain day, a Sunday afternoon, when there was a problem set that I was having trouble with about circular motion, a terrible subject. And I decided that if I could solve this problem set, then I was going to be a physicist. If not, I would do economics. My economics friends remind me from time to time that had I been really serious about a Nobel Prize, I would have done economics because, according to them, it's much easier to do that.
We need to, you know, early in the show here, kind of nail down some sort of basics about what we're going to be talking about today. So, I mean, what are quantum mechanics and what is the Higgs boson and what is the CERN collider where Roger works? Can you answer that question simply and entertain us with the answer? And Roger?
Over to me. Can I, in a nutshell, explain quantum mechanics?
Well, you don't have to do it in a nutshell, but well, at least do it so that we understand it.
Well, there's a wonderful quote from Richard Feynman from many years ago that if anybody tells you they understand quantum mechanics, they're lying. I shouldn't really try to explain. So basically, it's a connection between sort of the particle and the wave nature of matter. So the duality of those two, and you use quantum mechanics to basically, to understand sort of the world, which the microscopic world which we live in, and we need to use quantum mechanics for that. And it's a whole science which involves probability and explain quantum mechanics in one sentence, right? Okay, that's basically it.
Sorry.
Maybe I can put it a little more metaphorically.
Right, yes, you're probably much used to it than I am, right?
So in the 1920s, the people who invented this thing called quantum mechanics realized that in order to explain why my gold ring shines and the table is solid, you had to travel to a place which we don't experience in everyday life, a world a billion times smaller than our world, the nano world, we call it. So things that are of not dimensions, centimeters and meters, but a billion times smaller than that. And that, just as when we travel to foreign lands, the customs and laws that prevail there are not necessarily the ones of our everyday world.
Yep.
And in fact, we have no right to demand that world explains its laws in terms of what we bring to it any more than a junior year abroad student in Paris who has just learned about Freud and sees the Eiffel Tower and decides it must be phallic and then discovers that tower is a feminine noun in French. You just have to go with the rules that prevail there. And the remarkable thing about the nano world is that what we've discovered there, the laws that we discover there, actually determine what happens in our world.
I think it's useful for you to hear me as somebody who's not a scientist, the way you used the term billion. Billion. To me, a billion is, I think, it's unbelievable. I can't get my head around it. And I'm sure that 90% of our listeners are the same. A billion times smaller than what?
Than
me or even an atom, right?
Well, no, the atoms are living on this little scale.
They're living on this scale. So tell us, how small is an atom? Can you put that in some sort of perspective for people that don't understand this?
How do you explain a billion? So I think maybe if you could do it, if you divided things by two and keep dividing things by two, so cut in half, cut in half, keep cutting in half. In order to get to 1 billion, and guess if I can get this right, you have to divide it by something like 26 times. That's 2 to the power 26, which if I remember is roughly 1 billion. If you The best way to think about it, there's this wonderful thing called Brownian motion, which was discovered or observed in the 1890s or so. Microscopically, and what you had, you were looking at small particles in water, sort of small, tiny particles, and for some reason, they were moving slightly around, right? And what this motion was not understood at all. And in order to understand it, eventually it was shown, this was one of the famous 1905 papers by Einstein, that if you just say that these tiny particles of sand, which you can just see with a microscope, they are being touched by atoms, and that's causing them to move very slightly that you can see inside that. So it's something which is, so the smallest grain that you can see in a microscope could be the order of, a micron. Now, micron, so the average hair is about 80 microns, so micrometers. So start with a millimeter. So 180 microns, which is the size of your hair, will be 0.08 times one millimeter. Now, that would be the rough size of the particles you could see. The atoms which are there are about another factor of 1,000 or more smaller, but there were so many of them, and they're quite active and they're quite fun, and that was causing that motion. Yeah. That's the sort of the time when you actually sort of see in the macroscopic world direct consequences of things as small as atoms. Other ways to explain a billion, I mean, think of the national debt. right, everyone. What other?
Well, another way to do it is to jump to the macrocosmic and to look into space.
I find it so hard to imagine 13 billion years or 13 billion light years, for example, as a distance. So the distance between us and the next galaxy, oh, it's enormous, it's massive. It's
just the next galaxy.
Yeah, the next galaxy, just
and
next
whole,
door.
The whole sky filled with galaxies.
It's 100,000, so the size of our galaxy, I should know this, but it's about 100,000 light years across, right? And that's tiny on that scale. And a light year is the distance that light will travel in 1 year. So 100,000 light years is how far it would go in 100,000 years.
So we're not going anywhere.
And that's just next door, right? This is our this is our next door neighbors, right? Go beyond that to the next galaxy, then you're going much further and further away. So it's a really, the immensity of the scales, or the range of the scales which we have to deal with, which we have to think about, is always mind-boggling.
And so the thing that the book brought up to me in the parts that I read was the way the human mind can't grasp some of these numbers and some of these things. And when you look into space, and what we know, I know more about space than I do about quantum mechanics, but it's fairly obvious, isn't it, that space can't end, because if it ended, what would be beyond the end? So it's fairly obvious that it keeps going, unless there's something strange that we don't understand, which is highly possible. But all of this that we see is perhaps just also a pinprick itself that we see, and it goes on and on and on. Is that the same for what you are studying now? Are we looking down into that, and is there an infinite possibility of speck-like particles way further and further and further? Now, where does it stop?
Well, we don't know, which is one of the exciting things. Another exciting thing is that this man, the reason that he has such trouble explaining to you the size of an atom is that his experiments deal with things a billion times smaller than an atom.
That's why I said smaller than an atom.
Right. One of the exciting things about our science, astronomy, cosmology at the moment is that we are studying vast ranges of scales, so down to a billionth of a human scale in space, in distance, out to the whole size of the universe, whatever that may be, and in times much larger than the age of the universe are things that we can contemplate. And in terms of the processes that he's studying, they occur on a scale of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. So very fast indeed. And it's amazing that we have systematic ways of thinking about these ideas over a large range. And it's very important that we traverse large ranges, not only in physics, but in all of science. I think the great discovery of the 20th century was that the human scale, our size, our perception of time, isn't favored for understanding the universe. And think of a simple example of going to the zoo. You go to the zoo, you see a giraffe. The giraffe is not like you and me, but it's very different, so it's interesting in that way. You can look at a giraffe all day, but you don't really know what it is until you've studied its DNA and understood its relation to other animals, to other creatures. And you also don't really know what a giraffe is if you have, until you have seen the herd behavior, many of them interacting. So I think we find these things not just in astronomy and particle physics, but in biology and all sorts of other scientific disciplines, that getting the big picture is important, but then zooming in and finding out what we can learn from the very small is also very important.
We've got to take a break here. We've got to take a station break, and Eric is going to read the calendar for us. So we're going to take just a few minutes break here. Thanks.
KFAI is chuffed to welcome metallic hardcore stalwarts Wanderer Monday, March 25th at 7th Street Entry in Minneapolis. With support from Rot, Agony Reigns, and Visceral Reaction, this show is sure to liberate you from a brutalist existence. Tickets for Wanderer, Rot, Agony Reigns, and Visceral Reaction are available now at First Avenue's website. Visit first-avenue.com for more details.
You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric Zimmerman, and this is your What's Happening calendar of literary events, brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. On Wednesday, March 13th at 5 o'clock at Barnes & Noble in Calhoun Village, Chris Quigg will be talking about his recently released book, Grace in All Simplicity. On Wednesday, March 13th, 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Sociable Cider Works, there will be a discussion of Olga Dies Dreaming by Xochitl Gonzalez. On Wednesday, March 13th, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Red Balloon Bookshop, James Ramos will present his new young adult novel, Daniel Deconstructed. On Wednesday, March 13th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Majors & Quinn Booksellers, Lee Hendricks will present Peep Light, Stories of a Mississippi Riverboat Captain. On Thursday, March 14th at 3:30 at the University of Minnesota in the Tate Building, Chris Quigg will have a presentation on A Century of the Noether's Theorem. Not sure if I said that right. On Friday, March 15th at 11 a.m. to noon at the Hopkins Center for the Arts, Pen Pals presents Geraldine Brooks. On Saturday, March 16th, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Steeple Center in Rosemount, Minnesota, the Rosemount Writers Festival and Book Fair is happening, featuring keynote speakers David Bruins and J.R. Olson, writing workshops, and book fair with local and regional authors and publishers. On Saturday, March 16th, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Hearthside Books in Watertown, Minnesota, A.W. Powers will be promoting the Psychic Guardian Angel series of paranormal thrillers. On Saturday, March 16th, 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. at Red Balloon Bookshop in St. Paul, Laura Purdy Salas and Kayla Heron will present their new picture book, Oscar's Voyage. On Saturday, March 16th, 3 to 5 p.m. at Avant Garden Bookstore in Anoka, A.W. Powers will be promoting the Psychic Guardian Angel series of paranormal thrillers. on Sunday, March 17th, 5 to 6 p.m. at Majors & Quinn Booksellers in Minneapolis. Mill City Reading Series, Works in Progress, presented by the University of Minnesota MFA students in creative writing. On Monday, March 18th, 7 to 8 p.m. at Majors & Quinn's Booksellers in Minneapolis, Chris Kander will present The Young of Other Animals in conversation with Mark Haber. On Monday, March 18th, 7 to 8 p.m. at 16210 Eagle Creek Avenue, Southeast in Prior Lake, Club Book will present Tommy Orange, the author of There, There, and Wandering Stars. This has been your What's Happening calendar of literary events, brought to you by the Rain Taxi Review of Books. There are many other events you can check out at the Rain Taxi site at raintaxi.com. And now, this.
Here we are, we're back. You're listening to me, Ian Graham-Leask, here with Josh Weber, and we are talking to Chris Quigg about his book Grace in All Simplicity, and you're listening to Right on Radio KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis. So what we just ended up talking about was this massive distance between the macrocosmic and the microcosmic. Lots of people I've been looking at recently, especially thinking about what we should talk about tonight, they see metaphysics in that. And you write a bit about metaphysical thinking back in the day as this all came about. It couldn't have come about, could it, the science without the metaphysics, to start starting it off.
Well, that's a very deep question. I'm sure that
I only ask deep questions.
Of course. Wondering about the nature of the universe and why we're here and all of that is part of curiosity. And as you know, the 17th century gentlemen who invented science as we do it today referred to themselves as natural philosophers.
Yes.
So it grew out of that tradition. And there are people who have emphasized that through the ages. So, yes, of course, there are deep connections.
Did that end?
Perhaps mistaken to think that we can derive lessons for philosophy, metaphysics, religion from the momentary understanding of science. Science is always provisional, whereas in other disciplines or other human endeavors, people want to have eternal truths.
Yeah.
So we're not about eternal truths.
No.
We're about getting closer and closer to a real understanding.
We're looking at evidence, but it seems to me that there's a kind of boundary between the place where evidence grew and took over. And is it around Stephen Gray? You write quite a bit about Stephen Gray and his career and how he comes along. Is he the end of the sort of metaphysical impulse in scientists?
So Stephen Gray is a very interesting character from the early part of the 18th century. This was the time when people on the continent and in England were discovering electricity.
Yeah.
And he was a quirky character. The child of a dyer, had dyer himself, who was a science groupie, a person who as a hobby did experiments in electricity and was one of the first to understand the difference, the distinction between conductors and insulators, made the first telegraph in a very primitive form and so on. And what you see in he wrote in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London.
Mm-hmm.
And what you see there is a minute recording tedious almost of everything he did,
yeah.
so that others could reenact his experiments and see what they could learn and do variations on them. So this is the beginning of the transnational spirit of science, in which discoveries on the continent were brought to England and back and forth, and people started writing things down. One of the key features of philosophical transactions when it was invented by the Royal Society was that it was written in vulgar language, not Latin, but everyday language that everybody could understand.
Yeah, that's right. So when we jump into what obviously, you know, well, not obviously to everybody, but, you know, how many angels can stand on the head of a needle? You know, he's a long way from that, because he's starting to come into this place where he wants to actually right. measure that. But in a funny sort of way, it kind of works with what you guys are doing. And what is an angel? And, you know, what is a, you know, and all those kinds of things. But this notion that something...
I would, of course, ask how you know there are angels and
well,
what they are.
I don't believe in angels, but, I mean, the concept, though, is that something can be that small. And that then the ancients, certainly in the Dark Ages, they had that concept that something could be that small, and the whole homunculus thing that was around in the Elizabethan period.
On the transition from assertion to evidence, maybe I could read a little passage.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So my colleagues know that I have a complicated relationship with cosmology. It's not love-hate, it's just complicated. And this came to me when I was an undergraduate, so I'll tell you how it came about. The ageless question, how did the universe arise, has stimulated peoples the world over to try to make sense of their origins. David Adams Leeming's Creation Myths of the World describes more than 200 traditional accounts, none quite as snappy as these lines from E.E. Cummings in his poem One Times One from 1944. When God decided to invent everything, he took one breath bigger than a circus tent and everything began. Science does not yet have an answer. A second cosmological query, how has the universe evolved, has become a fully scientific question, but it was not ever thus. Chris recalls, I first noticed cosmology when I was an undergraduate at Yale. Our physics professors had the charming habit of providing unassigned reading lists of some of the classics of 20th century physics, many of which were available in Dover reprint editions that cost a couple of dollars, the price of a pig in a blanket at the Yankee Doodle, the local late-night diner. While preparing a term paper on the classic tests of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity, I was reading through the popular works of Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington, the most distinguished astrophysicist of his time and the most accomplished expositor of Einstein's theory. General relativity reinterprets gravity as a manifestation of curved spacetime and vice versa. As the revered Princeton theorist John Archibald Wheeler put it, space-time tells matter how to move. Matter tells space-time how to curve. In most circumstances, general relativity's predictions are indistinguishable to very high precision from those of Newton's well-tested law of universal gravitation. In some special circumstances in which the two theories differ noticeably in their outcomes, nature favors general relativity. It was Eddington who measured the deflection of starlight by the sun during the 1919 solar eclipse, confirming a key prediction of general relativity and making Einstein a cultural icon. The opening sentence of chapter 11 of Eddington's 1939 Philosophy of Natural Science brought me up short. I believe there are 156709611855466804471719145271670963231452561856319361031296 protons in the universe and an equal number of electrons.
Oh, wow.
You may not think this is quite as catchy as Call Me Ishmael, but these 80 digits got my attention with the same intensity.
Wow.
How could he know that? I asked myself. When I discovered that Eddington's number, which equals 136 times 2 to the power 256, issued from his fascination with numerology and that he had done the calculation during an Atlantic crossing, I wondered whether old Sir Arthur had gone round the bend. In this, I joined many of his contemporaries. Thus, I learned from Eddington that cosmology was faintly disreputable, the realm of speculation rather than prediction and verification. Cosmology was in desperate need of data. But I also learned from Eddington that maybe, just maybe, you could know in a crude sense about everything in the universe. That was astonishing. Cosmology might be fascinating.
Very good. Good answer.
Well, just to piggyback off what Ian's asking about, have you seen a resurgence of people in your field who have a more of a metaphysical treatment of physics now? You're talking about this, reminded me of my discussion with Sean Carroll, and he, I know now for at Johns Hopkins, is listed as a Homewood Professor of Natural Philosophy. Roger Penrose, I know he's now, I've seen some publications where he's really interested in describing consciousness as being like a quantum event. I was wondering what your thoughts were about that.
I don't think it's a widespread movement.
Okay.
Both of those are quite serious people.
Yeah.
Roger is so far in the clouds.
Which a lot of people have said that, too.
Yeah.
Well, the quite remarkable thing about him, because he does seem so dreamy, is that Chandrasekhar, the famous cosmologist and Nobel Prize winner, made early calculations of black holes and so on. He was a professor at the University of Chicago and a very sweet man. Whenever I would talk to him, he would apologize for taking my time. Whenever he was stuck on a problem, he would invite Roger Penrose to come to Chicago and talk to him and give a talk. And the talks were always, you know, off in La La Land. But somehow, in that dialogue, Chandra was able to make progress. So I don't
Have you met Penrose?
I have, yeah.
He's a force when you sit with him. The brain is...
He's a very interesting character.
It's more like an artist.
Sean is a bit, Sean Carroll is a bit more down to earth. He has, I think, from undergraduate days, been fascinated with philosophy, and he's trying to interest others in that.
Yeah.
There was a movement far less serious in the late 1960s, early 70s, of people finding in the physics ideas of that time resonances with Eastern mysticism and religions and so on. And those people were not terribly serious to my way of thinking.
Well, precursor to that was Niels Bohr as well, who also interests somewhat into Eastern mysticism,
Yeah.
So on that point then, I'm kind of curious then, there's a range of characters you describe in the book, and everywhere from professional scientists to amateurs to performers to introverted plotters. Which type of personalities have you found make the best physicist? Or is there no correct answer to that? And it takes a plethora of individuals to make strides in discerning the laws of nature.
I think what you said is right, that it takes a whole range of people. You know, there are people who work alone, quietly, people who work behind the scenes, preparing instruments or ideas for other people. And then there are the ones who can't wait to get out in public. We have a chapter on toolmakers that leads into the way that we think about modern forces, modern theories of forces. Because for us, the people who make tools are like the people who make great instruments. Maybe I read a little bit from that.
Please.
One of our devices seems scheming to talk about them as devices. But one of the things that we wanted to do in our book is to engage people with things that they have already experienced or might experience that have something, in our view, to do with the way we think about physics, and to try to engage them in that way, to think about their own experiences and how they might relate to what we're then going to go on and discuss. Some years ago, we visited a harpsichord maker in his New Mexico atelier. The artist and a retired Caltech physicist named Bob Walker showed us his materials, explained the various stages in the construction of a harpsichord, then treated us to a recording of Igor Kipnis playing Antonio Soler's Fandango on one of his instruments. But the object he took the greatest pleasure in showing was not a finished harpsichord. It was a block plane. Clean, precise, and utterly apt, that he had built in order to sculpt soundboards of surpassing beauty and eloquence. This maker of exquisite instruments was also a maker of peerless tools. We thrill to the playing of the virtuosi of our age. Violinists and their audiences revere the master luthier of Cremona, the Amati, the Guarneri, and Stradivari, who centuries ago invented the modern instrument and built the most magnificent examples. We wonder which tools those great craftsmen might show us with special pride if we could interview them at work, if we could visit them at work. Musicians and composers are just as much intertwined with the artisans and craftsmen who make the instruments as are scientists, both theoretical and experimental, with their tool makers. So Roger can tell you, in fact, he is a tool maker in some sense, about the experimental aspect of that. Less evident is that we have great theoretical physicists whose great gift is to make tools that the rest of us use.
That's very useful.
No, it's so on the experimental side. I mean, there's a very nice chapter in your book where you talk about the pleasures of the drive to make the experimental experiments and the accelerators and everything. It is, for me, basically throughout my life, it's been something which has been, there's a problem in physics. There's a question in physics. How can we, for example, I was on an experiment to look for the tau neutrino, the donut experiment, the awful name, but the donut experiment. And this was how on earth could we solve that problem? And that was like a lot of thinking, a lot of creative thinking, a lot of reading, learning about tools which were way outside of normal high-energy physics, like image intensifier technology. And those days, emulsions and emulsion scanning, which was an old technology that was used in the 50s, had been forgotten about, but actually said, well, with that technology nowadays could really make a big difference using modern optics and putting that all together to make a very interesting experiment. Basically, that's the joy of doing these things. Doing the experiments is like, you have a problem. How do I solve this problem in order that I can make a measurement which will, shed more light on exactly the on the question on the real questions which we've all learnt about in physics. I could go on about. So I was involved with the construction of one of these very large experiments. Me and 2,000 other people were involved with the construction of an experiment over in Switzerland, which had approximately, I think it's 100 million channels of electronics in it. And making all that work when you're working with people who we probably have in the experiment, I would guess, something like 30 different languages. The lingua franca of physics is English, fortunately, and some of us have actually benefited the fact that it's in Switzerland to learn French at the same time. one of my English colleagues when I was in Liverpool said to me, the great thing about CERN is to teach physicists French. but yes, the experiment that we built on CMS had, which is the one that I work on, which is called the compact muon solenoid, which is enormous, weighs 14,000 tons in material. I was involved with a process of developing a crystal, and I knew nothing about crystallography at the very beginning. But in the process of going from, in 1993, from one cubic centimeter crystal, which a friend from Belarus had brought over, said, this is really cool, we've used this in acoustic delays, maybe this scintillates. And we went from that to making 90 tons of this material, which is now installed in the experiment over in Switzerland, and we're using it to this day to measure the properties of the Higgs boson.
And you're talking about the CERN collider.
Experiment at the CERN collider.
Yeah. Yeah.
The collider itself is, as Chris very eloquently explains in the book, is a superconducting ring, 28 or so kilometers in circumference, which is filled with superconducting magnets. So this is magnets with niobium titanium wires, which have 8.3 teslas, which is much higher than the Earth's magnetic field. And that's used to steer protons around in counter-rotating beams, and they collide them with each other. And we build detectors which look at the collisions of those particles.
And tell our listeners what the purpose of that is.
That is basically to find out things like to study the basic properties of matter, In particular, one of the big motivations for doing this was because there was this big problem in the physics world. Where does where's the origin of mass, which is, again, very nicely discussed in Chris's book, of the Higgs boson, which is one of the predictions or one of the consequences of it. And we had a good idea in the 1990s where it was. And when we found it on July 4th, 2012, and we had this big announcement then.
I remember that. You were very happy.
Yes, I was very happy indeed. Right, it took a lot of work to get to it.
Yeah.
And that was like piecing together the what we call the standard model of particle physics. And that's something I've been working on since really November or October 1974, when I went to Imperial College as a graduate student in particle physics. And it's been, I still feel like a kid in a candy store. There are all these wonderful problems to think about and all these exciting things. We could do this very frequently, like once a week or so, there's a discussion. Maybe we could do. Right now the hot topic is something called superconducting nanowire single photon detectors, which is a really hot topic in quantum physics. Has very interesting properties, and there's some wonderful things which one might could do with that, and so address some other problems in physics, which are coming up.
And do you feel that grace in all simplicity explains these things?
I loved reading the book. Honestly, yeah. I mean, I'm not very good at reading books about physics because I know this stuff. I did. But this was it covered my career in physics. Beginning with the November Revolution, which I was like 2 weeks into graduate school when that happened. Mm-hmm. And it was like everyone was in Imperial College was getting really excited about it. And it was like, and I just made the decision I would go to Fermilab to do physics.
Tell us about what that was, the November Revolution.
The November Revolution, right. So in the 1960s and the early part of the 1970s, there was some theoretical talk. Papers were being written by people like Chris that there was this sort of possibility that there might be a quark which we didn't really think existed, but it needed this sort of concept to be around. And then and the type of things we were doing, we were measuring scattering and the production of particles, and it's the whole particle zoo, and nobody really understood, but there were sort of ideas of how this came about. And then in November, there was November 11th, was it November 11th? November 11th, 1974, there were two results came out simultaneously, and quite who had precedent is not. One result was in Long Island, an accelerator at Brookhaven National Lab in Long Island, which was observing in what we call two muon decay, and the invariant mass of those particles. There was a very, very narrow resonance, totally unexpected. Everything up around that was 3 GeV, 3 times the proton mass. Everything around there was sort of very short-lived, would decay away well before, and so, but these things seemed to be really tight and very small and completely unexpected. And the same thing was observed over at Stanford, at the Stanford Linear Accelerator. Same thing, they observed in the collision of two electrons, they observed these electrons being produced and reconstructed to exactly the same state. And it was like, this was so unexpected by us experimentalists, by the theorists not so, but by the experimentalists. This was not all. We were just used to doing bubble chambers. And at that time, we were doing something called partial wave analysis. I'd learned a lot about partial wave analysis, and I bet I had to forget about it within about 2 weeks, right? And then a whole new world. It was a whole new world that began then. And I arrived at Fermilab about 5 months later. I mean, I remember shortly afterwards, we went up to, because we didn't have the preprints at Imperial that we wanted, we went to the Rutherford National Lab, which was a short train ride away, where we actually were doing another experiment at the time. And I sat in the library with my thesis advisor. We went through Galileo Rosner's paper, mm-hmm. and we worked at it. Well, this is really interesting. That was really an exciting time. And this was like, wow, there's something wonderful here that's starting to make sense. Mm. And since then, I've been on many experiments sort of looking at different parts of it. And then finally, the Higgs boson in 2012 was like the culmination of many different measurements and tests that we'd done, all part of the building up the general picture of what we now call the standard model. And when we do experiments at the Large Hadron Collider, the physics which we use to describe events is now, and the way we can describe it is now so precise that we can start to look for minor deviations away from that physics, just by because we can really we understand things so much better than we did.
And you can you can read about this in Chris and Robert Kahn's book.
And the book really, I really enjoyed reading it because a lot of it, the stories I'd heard already, but I was glad to hear them again. But there were some other ones there which I hadn't heard of, which were really, really interesting about.
There's some spooky stuff.
On the November Revolution, just one remark. One of the best things that can happen to you in science, maybe in other areas, is to discover that nature takes your ideas even more seriously than you do.
I love that. That's very elegant. That's
a great way to end up, actually.
The unfortunate thing is that we didn't get to talk about dark matter and some of the
dark energy.
All these things today. But real quickly, what are you going to do in your lectures, just for any listeners that are going to show up and see that, which I hope.
Yeah, what upcoming events do you have going on?
Tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock, there will be a book event at Barnes & Noble, and you can give the address as a local.
It's in the Calhoun Village.
Minneapolis.
In Minneapolis, very close to Bina Miskar.
And in the spirit of having conversations with our readers, I would welcome the opportunity to have conversations with people who have been or are not yet readers about anything that's on.
It's a lovely, it's a good bookstore.
We've
run various kinds of readings.
Tomorrow there's a very technical talk at the university to which I don't invite people.
They can come, but they may
in
not.
In general, because it's going to be a blitz. But on Thursday, there will be a rather historical and not very technical lecture about Emmy Noether, the famous German mathematician, who in 1918 proved two theorems, which it took us all decades to understand and to apply, serve as the basis for our understanding of the laws of nature today. Mm. So she's a very interesting character with an interesting, complicated life. And I'll talk about that and about some of the
science. Where is that?
That's in Tate Hall.
At the University of Minnesota on the East Bank campus, very close to the mall.
Okay. And that's how you pronounce it.
Tate Hall.
Noether. Noether,
right?
Noether.
Noether.
Yeah. Emily Noether.
Yeah.
Fascinating person.
But if you'd like to say Noether, that's fine.
Yeah. Around here they say they'll say Noether. Like they say Goethe, don't they?
Goethe.
Goethe.
Oh well.
Goethe.
Oh well, it's English. So it looks like we're running out of time, Josh.
Yes, we are. Thank you so much for your time with us, Chris. Roger, of course, thanks for being in the studio with us.
Thank you for inviting us.
And now this.
Programming on KFAI is sustained by underwriters like the Ordway and the Lake Street Council. Thank you so much for your support. Learn more about becoming a KFAI underwriter at kfai.org/underwriting.
So my sister says to me, donate your old car to KFAI. And I say to her, you mean just give it away? You're crazy. Then my sister says, okay, how much is that car worth to you? And I say, nothing. She says, what would a dealer give you? And I say, nothing. And she says, well, it's worth something to KFAI. Give it to them, and they'll get some money for it and use it to make the radio you love. I know she's right, but I say, I bet it's hard to do. And she says, no, just go to their website, fill out a form, and that's it. They haul your car away, and you're done. Except that you might get a tax deduction. And I say, I guess Mom was right after all. You are smarter than me. And my sister just smiles.
Go to kfai.org, click donate, and scroll down to vehicle.
You've been listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Josh Weber. We'd like to thank Chris Quigg, Roger Rusak, and our listeners. Your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. Now stay tuned to Bonjour, Minnesota.